Ready to take a deeper look at where history, politics, and economics all intersect? Well, then you've come to the right place. Each week, here's where we pull back the headlines and focus on the big trends, the stuff that actually shapes our future. Through the noise, we focus on the signal. I'm your host, Neil Howe, and this is Demography Unplugged. Today is May 19th, 2020, and this is Demography Unplugged. Welcome back, everyone. As we did last week, I have on my podcast my fellow analyst, Christian Ford, who I believe is still in Maine. Christian?
How you doing, Neil? I'm doing good. The weather's finally starting to get nice up here. No more snow.
Yeah, well, it's getting nice everywhere, and that's going to be have interesting consequences for which we'll discuss on our COVID report. That's kind of the opening up of the Northern Hemisphere. As always, I want to tell all readers, if you want to dive deeper into everything we talk about in this podcast, please consider subscribing to our research product, Demography Unplugged, which I put together with my team at Hedgeye Risk Management. You can Google it. Among other things, you will be able to get our newswire, and we're going to actually talk a little bit about some of our newswire items on this show, and watch my weekly show on COVID-19. And just a note up front, we will be skipping next Tuesday. This is kind of part of Memorial Day weekend, and we will be back with you all on June 2nd. Today, we're going to talk about the V-shaped recession, V for vaccine. So we're going to get a little bit into that. That was a huge boost to the markets yesterday. We're going to talk a little bit about COVID trends. We're going to talk about politics, U.S. and world economic indicators, a bit about markets, world politics, as always. And at the end, I want to talk, there are, as I mentioned, two newswire items we had recently that were both very interesting, I think at least. And one, I believe we did last week, which was the increasing hardship of late wave boomers facing retirement. These are people born in the, anywhere in the, I'd say from the mid and late 50s. This is this new cohort that's beginning to, you know, move into their retirement years. Some just incredible statistics. The complete evaporation of the defined benefit pension plan, and even the failure of defined contribution pensions. Barely 40% of workers age 55 to 64 are currently eligible for defined benefit, defined contribution plans. This is, you know, your familiar 401k and, you know, KEO and all that kind of stuff. And an incredible 55% of this group, this is a group age 55 to 64, just pre-retirement, 55% have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. One third has less than $50,000 saved. In the context of this new COVID pandemic lockdown, that creates some real issues. Actually, it was even reflected in the design of the CARES Act. You know, it allows you to take what little you have in there and cash it out and use it now, right? Great idea. Okay. and then we're going to go. We have one other one I thought was a little different tone, and that is the rise of Q Anonymous, or QAnon, or simply Q. And that is the a piece we entitled Are Americans Losing Their Minds? But it's the rise of conspiracy thinking in America. People who follow Q tend to be Trump voters, and we'll find out why. This is kind of a conspiracy way of looking at, you know, what's going on with the New World Order and the cabal at the top who's trying to take over. But I'm going to be saying something I think very interesting, or at least I think a little different, about the generational appeal. What age bracket do you think most follows QAnon? And that will be interesting, and maybe for some of you a little surprising. So we'll talk about that later. So with that as our wind-up, why don't we just, Christian, plunge into markets. Tell us what happened last week.
All right, well, over the last five market days, the S&P 500 is up 0.81%, and the global Dow is up 0.55%. And as for volatility, the VIX closed yesterday at 29.3. If you remember, Neil, last week it was hovering in the 27 range.
Ah, a little bit up. Well, we had a couple of bad days, and then we had a really good day yesterday. Right. And once again, the U.S. beats out the rest of the world. It's amazing. They're just parting company. We've talked on earlier shows about why that is. But again, you see it's happening. VIX at 29, that's still 50% above normal. I take normal, actually the average, as around 19 or 20. That's not the median, though. I think the median is actually considerably lower. You know, that's the problem with VIX. The median is a lot different from the mean. And that says one of the problems about betting in markets. Okay. So that's what happened in markets. And why did the market go up so much yesterday?
Well, Neil, it was the news on the new Moderna study, a possible vaccine. And so what people should know is this was a phase one study. It was actually only trying to figure out if it was even safe to start giving people Moderna. So only 45 people were vaccinated. And out of that 45, they tested 8 of them to see what their antibody level was. Now, every single one of them had the same level of antibodies as someone who had had COVID and then recovered. This, people were very excited about this study because now it looks like they'll be able to go on to phase two, which will be bigger and more focus on the effectiveness.
Yeah, well, this is a problem, actually, though, with testing effectiveness. I don't believe that we're actually doing challenge trials yet. I guess we don't feel desperate enough to do that. The typical trial will just, you know, let these people out into the population and then just kind of track over time how many of them actually get sick, right? A challenge trial would be sending them into actually exposing them to the virus. You know what I mean? That's what you do when you're really desperate. And you think we'd be doing that, actually. I could easily imagine giving a bounty to a bunch of millennials, right? And just saying, as 100 of you, we're going to expose you to the virus. And, you know, you're going to earn, I don't know what, $15,000. And I can imagine a lot of young people would say yes to that. It would certainly speed research, right? And here's what you have to understand. By the way, this kind of takes me into my my weekly COVID call. But this is an RNA vaccine, and it is a very, very ingenious technology. What this vaccine does, it is a magic bullet in a way, that it goes into your cells and tells the interior, the kind of DNA part of your cell, actually not the DNA part, but the RNA, it is an RNA which actually takes proteins in your cells and actually creates and manufactures virus proteins, little bits and pieces of the spikes, right? The things that that actually are the antigens in your body that your antibodies are designed to counter, right? So it basically is instructing your own body to create tiny little virus protein spikes. And all those little virus protein spikes are created by all these cells, and they go out and they trigger your B cells and T cells, it would be your B cells, to create all these antibodies. And then the T cells have to join in and, you know, have this real big orchestration. And that creates what appears to be the equivalent of immunity, right? And that's the exciting part. That's the very positive part. I'm excited about it. So here, though, is the problem. It doesn't replicate the actual process by which a real body becomes immune to an actual virus. And anyone who studies biology, physiology, I think is just awed by the complexity of the human body. An actual virus comes in and it gets swept up by macrophages and dendrites, and it's kind of taken out into the extremities, the lymph system, and then it's discovered by B and T cells. And there's an incredibly complex process by which antivirus parts are actually presented by your innate immune system to your acquired immune system. And there's a very complex order in which all of this happens. And it would be great if these antibodies themselves conferred immunity, but the actual immune process involves more than just antibodies. It involves, for instance, killer T cells, and it involves T cells themselves that are helper cells that help, you know, modulate the immune response of the antibodies. We don't know if that actually creates real immunity to a real virus. And I think that only time will tell. And I think it will take time to tell. That's the problem with this whole process. And that's why vaccines usually take a lot of time to develop. You need time. It's not just getting rid of regulations. You need time to actually discover and examine what's going on in the human body. I will say that the old-fashioned way of vaccination, which was simply to take a live vaccine and to somehow deactivate it, you heat it up or you give it formaldehyde or something, and then you just inject it into the body, that much more closely replicates the whole process of actually becoming infected. That's not what they're doing here. So I would just say that my take is this is extremely technologically advanced and clever, and it would be incredible if it worked. I think the problem is, does this actually confer real life immunity in such a complex system as the human body? Moving on to trends worldwide, I have noticed a great site, if anyone likes to watch this stuff. It's Epiforecast. It's actually put out by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And they have R-naughts and infection growth rates or declines in every country of the world. They even have many countries by regions. It is by far the most detailed global map, up-to-date map of infection trends that I've seen. I just kind of reported here for listeners who are interested in tracking it down. They do show that most of the world infections are still rising, with the I guess notable exception of most of Western Europe, not Sweden, of course, and probably not the UK, but the rest of Western Europe, some of Eastern Europe. Canada is at least neutral. It may be still declining. United States is still rising. And Latin America, Christian, is one bright red spot. And Brazil is one of the worst. And I actually saw that Brazil is rising now to, what is it, number three or number four among total national deaths. I can't remember. Do you recall that, Christian? Right. Something, I think it's now.
I believe.
Where is it? It's over.
I believe they're around five.
They're number five now. They're over Italy or over Spain.
Yeah, I could be slightly off.
Yeah. But here's, you know, Jair Bolsonaro, who has completely dropped the ball on this. And I believe that Brazil is definitely a place where they're undercounting. And keep in mind that, as we all know, Brazil is not a cold, dry place. So this may put to rest some of the, you know, people who believe that, you know, a hot, humid weather may actually stop the virus in its tracks. Weather does have an impact on almost all viruses, and I'm sure it will have an impact on the coronavirus. I believe, however, and I've presented this on the past, that it will be a relatively minor impact. Stay tuned, by the way, on my COVID report on Thursday. I'm going to talk about the amazing possible importance of vitamin D levels. I've talked about this in the past. I believe there's a strong correlation between vitamin D levels and, you know, sicknesses and diseases of all kinds, particularly viral infections, meaning higher vitamin D levels, you're less likely to get them. They're going to be less serious. And most of all, with acute respiratory disorders, which is the main reason why people die from COVID-19. But there are the first two studies out. These are both from Southeast Asia, actually looking at the correlation between vitamin D serum levels and how you do in COVID-19. And the results are just astounding. I mean, it turns out that the vast majority of people that are doing very poorly with COVID-19, either getting it very severely or dying, even after adjusting for age and pre-existing conditions, have low levels of vitamin D. So I'm going to talk more about that on Thursday. I think it's very interesting. This is ultimate low tech, right? Christy, we talk about all the time.
Right.
I am convinced that a lot of the things that really we do know that work, for instance, you know, passive immunity through through plasma transfusions or things like vitamin D, these things actually are turned out to be extremely important. Politics. We did want to say something about U.S. politics. And I think, Christian, you had some interesting news on this new Democratic CARES 4 or CARES 5 pack. I guess it's CARES 5 now that is just passed the House. Is that right?
Correct. This is a new bill that in total would be $3 trillion.
Wow.
But as most people are saying, it's pretty much dead as it goes to the Senate. There are a few things that they think maybe Republicans and Democrats could compromise on. That is some funding for state and local governments, some kind of PPP revision, increasing broadband, and giving some money to the Postal Service to keep it going.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I don't know. I don't see Mitch McConnell agreeing to, you know, bail out Illinois or New York anytime soon.
Right.
I think there's some states that are probably not on the top of his list. And we'll see actually how much the Fed is actually going to do that, because the Fed is now backstopping, you know, Mooney debt. Some of this stuff is going to actually expire soon, right? That actually creates an, I think we've talked
right.
about that. For instance, the extra federal unemployment benefit will expire on July 31st. I believe some of the earliest people they got the PPP, you know, the businesses to get PPP help, that will probably start expiring sometime toward the end of June, right?
Yeah, that goes till the end of June. And the unemployment additional ends on July 31st.
So this creates an interesting question. What are the Republicans going to do? I think, you know, Senator Graham has been quoted as saying, you know, they're going to extend that those huge unemployment bonuses, you know, over my dead body or something like that. You know, he was one of the
right.
three senators who originally objected to it. But it's a very interesting question, because in many industries, I'm thinking particularly of retail and hospitality, what you can get in a state unemployment benefit, you know, a typical state unemployment benefit plus the $600 a week is considerably more than the average wage in that industry. So I'm asking the question, is this not a serious, I mean, aren't the Republicans right? Is this not an serious supply impediment to the economy reopening? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, Neil, you and I were joking earlier that I was driving around in my town and there was a sign outside of a Dunkin' Donuts and it said, now hiring $13 an hour, and it had a big exclamation mark.
Wow.
And we were joking.
Well, yeah.
You could make more money staying home.
Even Maine's average benefit plus $600 will get you certainly over $20 an hour. So that is a joke. I mean, you know, unless
right.
you're just ineligible for the benefit, why in the world would you go back to work for that? You couldn't consider it a job you really want to do, you know, just for the joy of it. And, you know, you're undergoing the risk of getting sick every day. I don't know, Christian, you explain that to me.
Yeah, I don't see if you are eligible. I don't know why you would take that Dunkin' Donuts job.
Yeah, I actually consider this a really interesting loggerheads now between Democrats and Republicans. And I can see each one of them has something, you know, a good argument to make. The Democrats are going to make the argument, which is probably a pretty good one, that, you know, we've bailed out the S&P 500. We've bailed out everyone else. And certainly higher income workers aren't feeling the pain. Why can't we continue to do more for the people who have to go to work? I mean, you know, and that's a very strong argument to me. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me. On the other hand, there's this argument that how do you get the economy going again if you're basically paying people not to take any of these jobs? Anyway, we're not going to resolve that here, I guess. Not right now, anyway. economic indicators. I know there's something that's been happening in the U.S. and around the world. What has it been?
Yeah, well, if we start in the U.S., we got industrial production month over month for April, which came in at minus 11.2%. Now, this is its largest drop in its 101-year history. Now, Neil, do you know what historical event was happening 101 years ago when this started?
Yes. Well, that was actually the tail end of the Spanish influenza. Yes, I know that very well.
Correct.
And that was the second of two recessions in a row coming out of World War One. And that was a terrible recession, by the way. That was the biggest episode of deflation in 1 year in American history. I believe that was going into 1919 to 1920. It was a very severe recession. It was not long lived, nor, as I recall, was Woodrow Wilson, who only had a few months to go at the time. But anyway. That's just, you know, these are amazing numbers, aren't they? That's more
than
any single month during the 1930s. So, you know, for what's that worth? What else happened?
Big news, retail sales came in for April month over month, and that was negative 16.4%. That was its sharpest decrease ever recorded. The hardest hit in retail was clothing sales. That came at negative 78.8%.
Not a huge demand for clothing right now. And not a huge demand for actually being in a clothing store, which has made me more the point.
Right. You know, electronics were down 60%. Food and drinking services, they were down 29.5%. You know, there is still some takeout, so that wasn't as extreme.
Right. Well, go ahead. Don't let me stop you.
Other indicators, we got the New York Empire State Manufacturing Index. That was negative 48.5 for May. In April, that had been negative 78.2.
That's a huge rise.
Right.
Okay, got it. But yeah, that's still an amazing number. Okay.
And then we also got Michigan consumer expectations. This is preliminary for May, but it's 67.7. And last month, it was 70.1. So expectations are dropping.
But I think current conditions are slightly up. So that's kind of interesting. That's actually, I think that's what you'd expect. I think current conditions obviously rose a little bit. We opened up a little bit last month. I guess recently, I should say, compared to the worst of April. But future expectations, I think, are beginning to dim. What about around the world?
Well, in China, we got some interesting numbers. We got industrial production year over year, which was 3.9% for April. Now, this is its first growth since December. And while production might be growing, we also got retail sales year over year, and that was minus 7.5%. For April.
But it's interesting. I want to emphasize this is year over year, which is actually
right.
A very good sign for China. It actually means that its workers aren't consuming anything, but at least they're back to producing stuff.
And Neil, would you say that this production is them catching up, or where is this coming from since these retail is still quite low?
I think a lot of it is just catch up and inventory and a lot of stuff that was just completely left for nothing in February and early March. They aren't producing it for export because we know exports are down. Mm-hmm. In other words, this has to be a catch up to domestic demand for stuff that was just left unfinished. It's the only way I can explain it.
Got it. Well, out of Japan, we also had some big numbers. We had GDP growth annualized, the preliminary for Q1, and that came in at negative 3.4%. So that is two straight quarters of contraction, which, you know, means recession. But we have been talking about Japan going into a recession since, I don't know when, September, Neil?
Yeah, I think September, November. Look, we knew Japan was going negative early in Q4, right? And we obviously... everyone knew they were going to be. In fact, we predicted before the pandemic that they were going to be negative in Q1, regardless of the pandemic. Right. And of course, they're negative in Q1. So of course, and anyway, we I think for a long time, we said that Japan was going into recession first.
Right. Well, one last indicator we had came out of the Eurozone. We had industrial production month over month for March, which was, as you can assume, a record drop. It came in at negative 11.3%. In February, it had only been negative 0.1%. You know, it's not that shocking, right, but the numbers are coming in.
Enough of these bleak numbers. Yes. What have we got in politics? You mentioned something interesting about Brexit, which I actually found amusing.
Right. So Brexit talks started again last week. You know, it's kind of out of our thoughts with coronavirus. But at the end of June, there is a deadline that you have to decide whether they're going to extend negotiations past 2020. So it's basically a deadline for a deadline.
It's a deadline.
Right.
I mean, this is the ultimate in EU process government. So is Boris Johnson going to make the deadline?
That's the question. He has said in the past that he does not want to extend it, that he wants this done by 2020. You know, people are asking, how is coronavirus going to affect this? Now, you and I have talked, Neil, that this actually might speed up the process. I don't know if you want to explain how that could happen.
Well, the fact is that the continental European economy is in a very severe tailspin right now. They have one of the most severe recessions in the world. And in this regard, I want to actually update. This was actually a couple of weeks ago. We made a comparison, a rash and inaccurate comparison. We actually compared the first quarter GDP decline in the United States, which is minus 4.8. We basically said, well, you know, the United States was, you know, Eurozone was actually less. It was 3.8. And I should have known better. And an astute listener called us up later. He called us on it. And I was aware of it. I just wasn't thinking of it, Christian. The Eurozone, in fact, many economies around the world, particularly all the European ones, report their GDP growth numbers unadjusted. They do not compare them at a seasonally adjusted annual rate as we do in the United States. So you really have to multiply 3.8 times 4 or actually do the proper kind of exponential calculation, and you will see that their actual annual rate was minus 14.4% decline in the first quarter. Only 4.8%. I say only in quotes, 4.8% right. For the U.S. in the first quarter. So my point is, The Eurozone is in a very, very historically unprecedented decline right now. So the question for the UK is, what do you gain from them? And it's nothing to export to. And also, the Eurozone may be a little bit more desperate to make a deal. Remember, the UK is a much greater importer of continental goods, then the continent is an importer of UK goods. So yeah, you see how that works. In other words, the UK, I think its bargaining hand has been increased, and the importance of, you know, being able to do a lot of business with the EU is probably somewhat diminished.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have it. I do think, by the way, in the EU, and we've talked about it before on this podcast, you're going to have the same problems leading to threats of breakup of the EU as you had after the Great Recession. We're already seeing it. We've talked about some of those issues. The recent ruling of Germany's Constitutional Court actually disputing the ECB's power to engage in all this quantitative easing and buying up all this debt from Italy and Spain and Portugal and so on. And Portugal and Spain demanding that these northern economies give them grants, not loans. The Frugal Four versus the Friends of Cohesion. And who are the Frugal Four? They are Denmark, the Netherlands, Austria, and Sweden. Now, actually, it should be the Frugal Five, because everyone knows Germany is part of them. But Germany can't afford to be seen with them, because everyone knows that Germany is, you know, the real mastermind behind this, right? So they're really the Frugal Five. And who's on the other side? They call themselves the Friends of Cohesion, right? So this will be Italy, Spain, Portugal, France, who's siding with Southern Europe and all this, and all the Visegrad economies in Eastern Europe, you know, they all want the benefits, right? They all want the transfers. So this is just like Italy. And it's like Northern Italy to Southern Italy, only, you know, blown up into the scale of Europe. And I think this actually poses huge issues that are not going to be easily solved. And they can't just be solved by Mario Draghi again, or in this case, Christine Lagarde saying, I'll do whatever it takes. This is going to be beyond her power this time. We had one more story, as I recall, Christian, on Australia.
Right.
And Australia's beef with China, as I may say.
So this is an update from last week. You might remember that China has cut off most beef imports from Australia because Australia has been a huge supporter of bringing a proposal to the WHO for an investigation into the origins of COVID-19, especially what happened in China in the early days. And China has been threatening Australia and said, basically drop it or we're going to hurt you economically. And well, this Monday, what happened, China announced that they were going to impose about 80% tariffs on barley from Australia. And it seems to this day, Australia is not backing down. And as you've seen, Neil, the WHO annual meeting, which took place yesterday, and I think it continues in today, has had quite a few fireworks in it.
Yeah, I think that bullying strategy works better against, I don't know, the Philippines and Vietnam than it would against Australia.
Right.
And I wouldn't go that way if I were Xi Jinping. But, you know, I needless to say, we don't call strategy there, do we, Christian?
Right.
Anyway, you've got that. And meanwhile, Trump is again threatening to defund the World Health Organization.
That is right.
So,
and I'm not sure about that strategy. I feel like, you know, a lot of people in the WHO have actually agreed with Australia and the U.S. that there needs to be an investigation into China. And I think Trump has support. And I don't know if it's the best strategy to start defunding when they could put pressure on China.
Yeah, I mean, it's a case where I certainly agree with Trump in his criticism of China and his demand for an investigation. The strategy, though, just completely escapes me because now what's going to happen, China's already done this. They're going to come in with $2 billion and say, oh, we'll fund it instead of the United States. So we'll basically take over the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of wonder, where does that leave Trump? I mean, so, you know, how does that help you? Now you have a World Health Organization that's sort of run by the other side. I don't know. Something escapes me here. At the same time, he's threatening to take all Chinese investments out of the Federal Thrift Savings Plan. I don't know if he has the power to do that. It is sort of the civil service. It is part of the federal government. I kind of wonder if the president actually, by executive order, has the authority to do that. I'm sure that there will be arguments about that, but actually take their savings out of China. And needless to say, this is the worst relationship between the U.S. and China since Henry Kissinger and ping pong diplomacy back in the 1970s, I would say. I think it's safe to say.
Yeah.
So there we are, not on a happy note in world politics. Well, let's move on now to our a couple of Newswire stories. And the first one, as we're talking about, is boomers facing retirement. And just to go over those numbers again, barely 40% of workers aged 55 to 64 are currently eligible in their workplaces to participate in a defined contribution plan. And in that age bracket, 55% have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. Less than one third of people in that age bracket have more than 50,000. I would just say, Kristen, this is a retirement catastrophe waiting to happen. Now, right. I've written about this for a long time, and I would just remind people of the research work by Rob Chetty at Harvard, and he's looked at tax data to show this. If you want to look at the decline in generational mobility by birth cohort, everyone thinks, oh, that's when, you know, Gen Xers, you know, it was people born in the 60s and 70s, or, you know, millennials, they're the ones who aren't, you know. It's actually not true. I've written about this often, but if you look cohort by cohort on whether you will attain the living standard of your parent, either mother or father, by age 30 or by age 40, the big decline is first wave to last wave boomers. It's born from the mid-1940s to the very end of the 1950s or the very early 1960s. So that is actually the decline. And the big decline in economic welfare later in life is actually from early wave boomers. In other words, compare two cohorts. Look at, you know, I don't know, Bill Clinton and Al Gore, you know, early wave boomers, right? Their group is doing fine. In fact, their group, born right around the early to mid-1940s, may be the wealthiest, you know, seniors ever. And they will continue. They will, for a long time, they will maintain that record. There will be no competition from later-born Americans. But you look forward and you go, by the time you get to the late 60s, you know, so we're talking about kind of your Michael Jackson, Madonna cohorts. You know what I mean? You know, late 50s, right. You know, people born in the late 50s. That's when all the decline is. And interestingly, these boomers, the first wave boomers, tended to have secure, stable childhoods, which they recall as being mainly in the American high. Very little divorce. School systems work really well. Some of the highest SAT scores ever. Very high share of that generation, of that cohort, became professional. They've done very well throughout their lives. They got their first jobs in the late 60s very often, and or early 70s when the economy was hot. And you can just, you know, they had many of the advantages of the silent generation. A lot of their savings years were when the economy was doing really well in the late 80s and 90s and aughts and so on. Whereas you look at the ones who are born later, those born at the very end of the 1950s, early 1960s, you know, they came of age with disco and a horrible economy, and they have done so much worse throughout their lives. And by the way, their childhoods were much more unsettled, because the whole culture revolution, you know, the rise in crime, drugs, family breakup, hit them all at a younger age, right? So consecutively, cohort by cohort, right? All of the confusion and a breakup of sort of the stability of the family, the community and politics and all the rest hit at a younger and younger age for these boomers. Gen Xers, yes, had a very unstable and, you know, throwaway childhood, but they really inherited what the very end of the boomers experienced. But the real transition was among boomers. And I tell people that when you're now looking at people who are now retiring, another incredible statistic, and we reported on this a couple months ago, the huge rise in bankruptcies among people in their late 60s, early 70s. A threefold rise in bankruptcies. These people can't, you know, pay their debts. There's less employer paid health care for them by far. And of course, they're at the age, you know, when they get into their late 50s, early 60s, where they have a lot more health care, right? Mm-hmm. A crushing cost of kids and their education. They have more debt. They're borrowing against their homes. The silent generation, they still paid off their mortgages. You look at boomers, particularly late wave boomers, their home is the home they own is their ATM. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's where they, you just HELOC, you know, give me more cash. And as a result, they have very little equity. Anyway, not to put too grim a picture on this, but there is one thing I've been noticing. I've occasionally written about it. There's an enormous homeless wave. That is to say, if you look at homelessness by age, you find that today the biggest homeless cohort are people today in their late 50s and just beginning to move into their early 60s. And guess what? If you had gone back 10 years ago, They're in their late 40s, going into their late 50s. You go back 10 years earlier, they're in their late 30s, going into their early 40s. You see what I mean? You know, in other words, it's the same group of people just getting older. A number of articles have been written about this, actually alerting state and local authorities to actually be prepared for homeless that are now much older and much more in need of health services and obviously vulnerable to various things, including, by the way, COVID-19. And you see very high infection rates compounded to the fact that you have an older population that's more likely to get seriously sick or die from this.
Right.
Wow. That's a really negative story. I raised something else very early on, and that is the part of the new CARES package, which actually allows you to take up to $100,000 out of your IRA, 401k, without penalty and without having to pay any taxes on it for a while. You can defer your taxes, for a various number of years. And I just think, what a sad commentary, right?
Mm-hmm.
In order for these people who often have mortgages, family responsibilities to keep themselves afloat now, they have to take money out of a retirement plan that they have, which is so clearly inadequate. To me, we're setting up terrible consequences for the future. And I think the future of retirement, where we think of today, a lot of boomers and Xers think of retirement as this wonderful time because they've looked up to their parents, right, who were much more affluent. They think, gee, this is a great time I'm looking forward to. No, it's going to change. And I think retirement and being in those age brackets is going to change in its fundamental quality drastically as we go forward over the next two decades. So, lastly, we wanted to say something about this. And again, we always, run out of time, Christian. We got to time this better. we did a story, and I'm sure we'll have occasion, maybe or not, to come back to this. We did a story on the rise of of QAnon or QAnonymous. And this is an amazing phenomenon. Those of you who don't know, Q, he or she, we don't know which. This is sort of Satoshi Nakamoto. You know what I mean? We have no idea who this person is. But Q is an unidentified agent with high-level security clearance who spies on the deep state on behalf of ordinary Americans. And if you follow Q, I kind of predict something about your worldview and something about your demographics. If you follow him, you probably believe that everything you hear from mainstream or official sources is a sham, a cover-up for a New World Order conspiracy hatched by a secretive cabal of tycoons, experts, and pedophiles. That's right, pedophiles who seek to corrupt and enslave the world. It turns out that you survey these people, many of them have an evangelical background. They look forward to a great awakening or the end of days. They like to follow obscure clues. And a number of articles actually explain some of this. It's actually fascinating. It's like following the X-Files. I mean, it's what you could do in lieu of doing a crossword puzzle. And it's actually, some of it's very challenging. It's kind of interesting in its own way. We know that the large majorities of people who follow Q voted for Trump in 2016. They will vote for him again. And his influence has grown so rapidly, Christian, that Trump now regularly echoes Q phrases and retweets Q link sites. There's a huge industry on Amazon for Q books, cups, trinkets, courses. There are a lot of people who have huge followings on YouTube and Twitter interpreting Q's utterances. And by one estimate, and I got a kick out of this, some 40 candidates running in primary races across America for Congress in 2020, mostly but not all Republicans, use Q slogans in their social media campaigns. they are mostly male, although there are a lot of women Q followers, mostly male. And here's the interesting, because I did want to talk about this, age. Most Q followers, and I've looked, and actually you can even see this in the people running for Congress. they're all in the age bracket. They're from the early 30s to early 60s. Christian, Generation X is the sweet spot for Q.
Right.
And I have a lot of reasons for this. And here's the fundamental one, and simply that Gen Xers as kids were raised to be wary and skeptical of anything the establishment tells them. They are free agent individualists. They are a generation of low social trust. They're devoutly loyal to family and friends, but they have very little attachment to national civic life. You know what I often say about Xers, right, Christian? They just want government to staff their radar screen, right?
Right.
Just I hope government doesn't notice me. And it's for that reason that I think conspiracy theories come very easily to Xers. This is a generation raised on anti-hero cartoons. And they've watched an endless fair of shows like Men in Black. I mentioned the X-Files. Hoaxes, treacheries, mysteries that never get solved, right? And I found personally, when it comes to a lot of Gen Xers, things like the assassination of JFK or Martin Luther King or Silkwood or Waco or 9/11 or vaccinations or the plandemic, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've heard about the plandemic, haven't you?
Yes.
Yeah, it's all around you right now. Well, their attitude is, who really knows? Why should I accept your version of the truth? And not only that, but what about the Apollo moon landings? Did they ever really happen? Or Roswell, the curvature of the Earth? I mean, I don't know. I mean, why should I accept the experts anyway? So you look at one thing I've noticed, that older Americans, this would be early wave boomers or silent, they're too firmly rooted in kind of, you know, what they learned from trusted institutions to believe in this stuff. And I found that even ultra-conservative Republicans, and I know many of them who are over age 65, they tend not to go there. You know, they won't go there. And on the other hand, millennials, who are also a generation of low social trust, they can't go to Q because they tilt so heavily to the Democratic Party, right?
Right.
And so it's the whole pro-Trump part that turns them off. And there's... it's actually another interesting reason, in my opinion, and that is millennials want to bolster social trust by supporting stronger, not weaker, national institutions. So in effect, Christian, and I'm talking about your generation here, many millennials would choose to join the conspiracy, not fight it, right?
Right.
Join the Borg. Come on. I mean, come on, you and your friends, Chris. You don't want to join the Borg, don't you?
Well, Neil,
meld yourself into that great, yeah, what?
I was going to say, I don't know if you remember, but a couple years ago, there was that supposed rogue national parks Twitter that was telling people what was really going on and how the deep state is staying strong against Trump. And I remember millennials loved that.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, and this, yeah, this is my ultimate comeback, right? My ultimate comeback is... you know, you have, you know, Q fans are applauding Trump for standing up to the planners and the regulators and the so-called experts who are designing this pandemic, right?
Mm-hmm.
But millennials are asking a different question. The question they're asking is, where the hell is our oppressive deep state when we need it? You know, you know what I mean? Hey, we need a big deep state and we're not getting it, right? And that actually explains a lot, doesn't it? Anyway, we could have fun with this, and we may return to it. I actually, if you're a subscriber, you go into the piece. I have an interesting commentary. I actually would like to come back to this sometime on the impact of the late 60s and 70s on the upbringing of Generation X. Because although it has been said, and there's a famous essay and book by Richard Hofstadter, who's a very progressive historian, I believe it was written in 1964, and it was called The Paranoid Style in American Politics. And And it basically says that, you know, American conservatism or the right in America has always had this strong affinity for conspiratorial views, right? And it's the Freemasons or communism or whatever. But I think that is absolutely incorrect. I think the left is also just as conspiratorial. You go out in the far left, you know, long before millennials felt the burn, Christian, there were leftists who thought there was a conspiracy of, you know, big corporations or America spelled with a K, or, you know, white imperialism and all of that to enslave and corrupt America just the same way. And what is Marxism other than just a conspiracy view of history? I mean, think about it. Much of the left is similarly oriented around conspiracy theorizing. And in fact, one of the things I did in the piece in Newswire is actually draw some of the parallels. They have very similar ways of thinking. They have very similar networks. I mean, we have Guy Fawkes, anarchists and Antifas who are also, you know, speaking in code with each other. And I'll leave you with this one observation that I've often made, and that is both sides use the same born-again metaphors of being liberated through a higher level of awareness or consciousness. I'm sure everyone knows people on the left, and I'm sure we all know some social justice warrior who talks about being or staying woke, you know?
Right.
She's not woke yet, you know? She's really woke, you know? Well, that's fascinating, isn't it? Woke. Well, what does that say when the right similarly talks about an awakening or about red pill, blue pill? I mean, red pilling is a common expression on the right today, right? All the alt-right guys use it. Well, what is the red pill? It wakes you versus a blue pill that puts you back to sleep. And by the way, this is a metaphor that goes back to Gnostic Christianity. This has deep roots in Western culture, waking up to a new awareness, a new consciousness on both sides. We could talk so much about this, Christian, and it's a shame to let it go, but I think we have to cut this discussion short. As always, it's been a pleasure, and we will, you know, come back 2 weeks from now, not 1 week, 2 weeks from now. And as ever, thanks for listening to this week's Demography Unplugged. Talk to you all 2 weeks from now. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Demography Unplugged. If you like what you've heard and want to dive deeper, I've got some good news for you. I'm offering a special research service for subscribers. It provides unique insights you won't see anywhere else. Deep dive analysis, charts, videos, and much more. It's designed to help professionals and investors uncover hidden trends and critical developments driving world markets and economies. You can learn more about it online at www.hedgeye.com, or you can just Google Demography Unplugged. You can also follow me on Twitter at HowGeneration. That's H-O-W-E Generation.
This content is for informational purposes and does not constitute an offer to sell or buy any investment vehicle, nor does it constitute an investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. Hedgeye believes the information sources to be reliable but is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions. The opinions expressed are those of the individual speaking. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information is protected by copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient provided access by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited and subject to the terms of service at hedgeye.com.